This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here today for our interview episode with my colleagues, David Canfield.
Hi.
And Chris Murphy.
Hi.
We are entering into Emmy season and have two interviews for you today, which is so exciting. So we're going to hear conversations with Chloe Sevigny and Matt Rogers. And first up is going to be Chloe. So, David, you are the one who got to talk to the star of not one, but two huge Emmy season shows. How was your conversation with Chloe Sevigny?
Yeah, so this is an interesting moment for Chloe. She has two very different projects coming this season, both of which are airing right now. Russian Doll recently debuted on Netflix, and we talked a lot about her relationship with Natasha Lyonne, who directed her this season. She stars, she created the show. Of course, it's a very personal project for her, and she and Chloe are very good friends and have been for decades. So they really got to collaborate more closely on this than they really ever have before, despite having worked together on a couple things. We were very wary of spoilers because everything on the show feels like a spoiler, but we did get into the dynamic between their characters and particular challenges of playing a character who is involved in some of the craziness of the season, let's say. I mean, there's a lot of good detail there. And for Girl from Plainville, Chloe's really devastating in this show. She plays the mother of a teenager who dies by suicide. It's a kind of showcase, dramatic showcase that she doesn't get too often. And she really just nails it. And it's really powerful. And she's really aware, or she says she's aware in her conversation of not getting to show that kind of side of her talent too often and really relishing it. And so we talked a lot about that and what is hopefully next for her.
Yeah, I respect you guys for being wary about spoilers, but since Russian Doll is out, I do feel like, I mean, she's been in the previous season, but this season just allows her to do so much more and really pop in a way that I don't think she did in previous seasons. It's really exciting to watch.
Definitely. And it's interesting to hear her talk about how Natasha knows her and vice versa, and what that can bring out in an actor, and particularly for this show. It did a lot for Chloe.
Well, let's hear your conversation with Chloe Sevigny.
It's a busy spring for you, Chloe. You've got a couple shows out, which I think is very exciting as a longtime fan.
Thank you. Couple shows and a wedding.
Well, look at me not doing my research.
Not to get too personal. We should focus on the shows. But yes, that overarching, like, yes, busyness is, whew.
Well, I mean, I'll ask briefly about all that together. What is the feeling right now in this moment with the personal and professional colliding like that?
I mean, it feels good. You know, both the shows are like, well, Girl from Plainville is a little trickier to talk about. You know, I mean, we want to get out there. We want people to watch it, obviously. But it's not like... and I'm getting married. You know, it's like, it's hard to segue.
Right. I can imagine.
But yeah, no, I mean, really proud of the work, really proud of both the shows, proud of Natasha, excited to be getting married, all kinds, you know, it's like, it's a very busy, joyous moment. I was thinking back to like a couple years ago and I was like, will I ever work again without a home, without a boyfriend, like calling my brother crying? And now I'm like, do I ever get a day off?
And here you are talking to me. Indeed, yeah. You do not get a day off. Well, let's start with Russian Doll. This will come out after the premiere, but we should still probably be careful in what we say. But it's a really exciting new season. You obviously play a much larger part in this season after a briefer appearance in the first one. I imagine you and Natasha, with whom, of course, you're very close, had never worked together in this capacity, right? This closely?
Not in this capacity. We've acted together before. In the 90s, we first appear in If These Walls Could Talk 2 with Michelle Williams. And then we did a cult indie classic, Party Monster. But no, in season one, Nora makes a brief appearance, but pivotal in one episode. It's kind of, you know, gives a lot of the backstory to Natasha's character, Nadia. And that episode was directed by Leslie Headland, one of the creators. And season two, Nora appears a lot more in different capacities. And Natasha was directing and also acting alongside me. So yeah, we were much more in the thick of it together. And it was really an incredible experience. I mean, it was a real passion project, which I'm always attracted to, you know, showrunners, creators, directors that, you know, it's like a live or die situation. And with Natasha, it was really this. She was like, everything's riding on season two. And, you know, sophomore efforts often have that kind of pressure to them. But
yeah.
You know, she just had a lot to prove, and people loved the first season so much that it felt pretty high stakes.
Yeah. How did it feel watching her in action and being so under her, you know, and within her expression and being a part of it?
She reminded me a lot of David Fincher, who I worked with on Zodiac, just like demanding a level of excellency. I think Harmony Korine was also similar. He directed me in a film called Gummo and Julian Donkey Boy. And just like, they're just true artists, you know, and they want everybody else to be as excited as they are. And, you know, just the passion is like always like at like 150. And that's really nice to be around. And oftentimes in TV, you know, you have different directors coming in and they're passionate about the work and enthusiastic, but it's different than when it's one person's passion project, baby, whatever you want to say. So yeah, just being around her and seeing her like being quick on her toes and making adjustments where necessary, budget-wise, performance-wise, you know, location-wise, just seeing her brain really active is a sight to behold.
You mentioned being more familiar with directors and showrunners of that singularity. But of course, you've never, I would think, worked with somebody, been directed by somebody with whom you're so close. How did that impact you as an actor?
Well, the part is I don't want to say it's a stretch, but you know, she's dealing with some mental, you know, challenges. So there is always the like pushing it, you know, and just knowing that Natasha is really going to have my back. She's on my side as far as vanity is concerned. She's like not going to make me look bad. I feel like there's a lot of times where shows like, oh, it's really gritty and it's really real. So it's not a glamour show. It's like, but it's still TV or it's still a movie. You still want everyone to look beautiful. So like, I feel like I felt like, not to be so surface, but like it felt like I could relax more in the performance and try things in a way that I knew she was like going to make me look good. First of all, in my performance, and second of all, look good as in beauty wise.
Sure. Fair enough.
Yeah, because the first season I was not really happy with how I looked. I was like really frazzled and crazed and had this terrible wig that they just pulled off the truck. And she really like, I knew she was going to take care of me. And I feel like that gave me a certain ease within the performance.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about playing that part of Nora, of this character? It can be particularly intense at times, relating to her experiences and also what it reveals about the larger fabric of the show and Nadia. How did you key into her this season?
Well, I don't know. Where are we with spoilers? I forgot, because most of my
I think you scenes, can get the general.
Yeah, it's
general
kind
stuff
of more Nadia inhabiting Nora.
Yeah.
And I don't do impersonations. I'm not a comedian. I found that very challenging, actually. I was like, here's my friend of 25 years, something like I know this person. I can move like her. I can do this. And we got on set and then I'm like, okay, action. I was like, wow, this is really hard. And she would do a scene and then like, I would watch the monitor and then I would try and like do what she had done. And I was like, I just somehow I got in my head. I don't know. I just had a really, I found it very challenging. So we would have to like isolate real moments to do these, like, you know, mimic her body language, the way she talks, you know. There was like, we were doing a lot more actually on the set where we'd actually like have Nora play it as Nora than have Nora play it as Nadia, because they weren't sure in the edit how things were really going to work out either, you know, if people were really going to be able to get on board with the storytelling device. So it was like a little bit of like, it was a little treading water as far as just like trying things and hoping they worked.
Sure. But again, I mean, that easier to do that, better to do that probably with someone that you can trust like that.
Yes, for sure. For sure. She's a great director, a great friend. I don't know. But she'd be like, you know, when I do da 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 or whatever, when I do this thing, and there's like a shorthand that makes it somewhat easier.
I wanted to ask you about directing as well. I know you had started directing shorts a few years ago and are looking to do a feature. And I think it's interesting that it seems like you and Natasha both started directing roughly around the same time. Had you spoken about it? And did you gather anything from watching her on the show as a director yourself?
Yeah, we've been talking about it for years and, you know, trying to buoy each other and encourage each other. She really, you know, fast-tracked. But when we were first starting out doing shorts, you know, we were like watching each other's 20 cuts of each other's shorts, you know, giving each other notes. And but yeah, I mean, I think just as outrageous of a story as you have or concept like Russian Doll, you know, if you're out there and you're charismatic, you can get someone invested in it. So I think no idea is too big is really what one of the big takeaways.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/littlegoldmen.
Continuing over to Girl from Plainville, where you work with Lisa Chulodenko here, and you've worked with a pretty incredible array of filmmakers over your career. As you've thought about directing more, watching people like Lisa or Natasha or Luca Guadagnino or whoever, I mean, is there a kind of absorption for you in that, in working with them and seeing how they have different approaches that maybe would work for you as you get into it?
There is. I also think different actors react differently to different sorts of direction, but yeah. I always like a director who's super prepared, obviously, and then has ideas that I couldn't come up with or wouldn't, you know, just that has an arsenal of ways to look at a scene or a line or, you know, the character that's, you know, eye-opening, inspiring. You know, I know that Natasha actually had worked with a acting coach and gone through and like kind of played each character for him to figure out like ins and outs of like how to speak to the actors and really dig into each character so she would have more material to talk to the actors about. And I thought that was really a smart way to approach material.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Are there any filmmakers particularly who have stood out to you over the years? I know you just work with Luca again, and he's far from your only multi-collaborator.
Well, I've worked with Jim Jarmusch a couple times, three times. Yeah, I mean, Luca is an exceptional talent. He is actually someone who's prepared but not prepared. He'll like show up and be like, what are we doing today? Let me see the scene. And then he like come up with the most genius thing ever. And you're like, what? Right. How is this happening? There's no shot list? What? Like, he just is instinctual and intuitive. And I don't know, his brain just works like that. And he's like reading a million things at once. He has like four iPads, 10 newspapers. Like, I'm just like, how can you even focus? How do you know? I guess that's just, you know, he needs like this constant stimulation. Whereas like Jim is very measured and every word has a certain connotation and there's different preparation, you know, and he really leans on Fred Elms, who also worked on Girl from Plainville, a cinematographer. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of like, not only working with the actors, but how they communicate with DPs, I feel like is very helpful as a director. That I really am always staying very attuned to, because that's like a really important, you know, relationship on the set. And also like first ADs, and I love ADing. Like, I am a control freak. So like when I'm on set and things are going slow, I was like, what's happening? What are we waiting for? Who's doing what? And like, so I always go into AD mode, because I like, there's so much time. I don't want to say wasted, but there's a lot of time in between when the camera's rolling. So I'm always freaking out, because I was like, then we only get to do three takes. You know, F right. You know what I mean? Like what is happening now? Because we need more time in front of the camera. Thank you very much. Because that's my moment. And I need that.
I saw for Girl from Plainville, you'd said you were maybe a little worried about finding a way out of the emotion. It's another really intense character. There are some pretty harrowing scenes you have to play, especially in more recent episodes. Did you find a way out of it? Like, what kind of strategies do you have for separating?
Yeah, I'm watching other stories, other shows, listening to podcasts, really, like, because or else my, you know, I'll just keep kind of going over what we did during the day or thinking about, you know, scenes to come. So it's really a good way to, you know, escape. I mean, that's why so many of us love sitting down with a good TV show. I mean, last night, like, I could not wait to see the next episode of Winning Time and just give over to that world for an hour and, you know, fully immersive experience. So, yeah, there was a lot of that, you know, talking to friends at home, on the phone, you know, regular stuff that people do to stay grounded. Mm-hmm. Wine.
Wine.
The occasional glass of wine.
Wedding planning, maybe. I don't know.
Not yet, no. But yeah, and then also, you know, I think unfortunately during COVID times, it's hard to really socialize, but we were like trying to, you know, after work, stand around, talk to the other actors about what we did, just keep a perspective on what we were doing and a respect for it, and kind of trying to learn to leave work, you know, on the set a bit.
Have you in the past found certain roles hard to shake off? I mean, you're someone who has certainly not shied away from challenging or doing devastating material in the past.
I remember there was a season of Big Love, actually, which, you know, I was very invested in, and I loved that character so much. And, you know, we shot for 6 months out of the year for 5 years straight. And well, there was a strike in there somewhere, but writer strike. But there was a season when everybody was like, had it out for Nikki. Like, they thought she was cheating, this, that, the other thing. And I just remember, like, I was just getting all these like insults spewed at me all day long. And I was really affecting me. Because having to be open to that and taking that in and responding to it on screen, like, I was starting to feel like very fragile. I'm like, this is just a character.
Nikki could have to take a Nikki had to take a lot at times.
She did. And I mean, I feel like she was like one of the most misunderstood characters on television. Everyone's like, oh, she's such a bitch. She's that. I was like, she think of the world she's straddling, what she came out of. I think she was like,
yeah,
one of the more complicated, fragile characters. So yeah, I remember that being a hard year.
Yeah. Can imagine. Yeah. Nikki was a complicated one for sure. But also
miss that girl. Yeah.
In terms of the actual, you know, nature of playing this particular character in Girl from Plainville, I'm curious, over the course of your career, having done quite a bit of television, what do you gain from spending a little bit more time with a role? I mean, you mentioned Big Love 6 months out of the year for 5 years.
Right.
What about that appeals to you? I mean, you've done quite a bit of television at this point.
Right. I haven't done that many like series where I get to go back. I guess I did Bloodline. I did a few series. We did a few seasons. I guess, yeah, just learning, getting to grow with the character, getting the storyline to grow, you know, having the writers see something in you. I think I cite this with Big Love a lot in the beginning, like, first season or so, they're really writing more of the drama for me. And then they realized I was funny. So by the end, like, I was getting a lot of the comedy. So yeah, just having, you know, writers, creators discover your strong suits and then write for them is, you know, really, yeah, it's a great relationship to have.
Girl from Plainville, there's a balance, I think, in this character between, you know, what is at times a very raw, heartbreaking portrayal, but there's also a real grounded, enduring quality to her as well. Mm-hmm. How did you find that balance?
Well, I think a lot was in the writing. I think they didn't want it to be all just like doom and gloom, obviously. They wanted to really, you know, capture some of the, I don't want to say lighter moments, but other moments, you know, that she had with her son and other children. And we really wanted her to be, you know, multifaceted, not just like the grieving mom. And I think Liz Hanna and Patrick McManus, our showrunners, and all of our directors and obviously editors, really let us sit with the characters and have air and, you know, be in silence and not have to have this like high drama, high stakes pitch, you know, throughout. So I think that really lends itself to the performance and that kind of grounded feeling, soulful feeling that you get when watching it.
Mm. I saw you'd said this was perhaps the closest you'd come to the feeling of making Boys Don't Cry, which was a pretty striking statement. Why was that? What about that feeling with Boys Don't Cry do you remember? And how did that approach this experience?
I guess it was just like how emotionally I was affected by the story. I mean, it's a true story. And just living, you know, even briefly in what this woman must be going through, opening yourself up to those emotions was profound. And yeah, had a similar effect to how I felt when we were shooting Boys Don't Cry. And then after, you know, after was really hard for me, like doing all the Academy stuff and the whole awards, you know, circuit and all of that stuff felt really awkward for me. I was, you know, I was still pretty young and new in my career and just like, here we are doing all this and there they are in Nebraska. Like, I don't know. It was very confusing for me.
That is a unique element of this business. Is it something you've been able to square a little bit more as you...
A little bit. I mean, I know that Lynn like really wants people to hear her son's story and she was really behind the project and, you know, she's fighting for this law in Massachusetts. So I think like knowing that we had her blessing and awareness, and I think there's so much for, you know, all the Elle Fanning fans, young people tuning in, hopefully some of the material will resonate with them and how they communicate with their friends, what they see in their friends, who they then reach out to for help. Like, I think that there's so much for people to learn from this show and experience. And so to me, it feels, you know, important.
Hmm. You mentioned at the beginning of this, fearing a few years ago about perhaps not working again, not getting.
Yeah, I love that. Like the Frank Langella essay, "The Demon Seesaw." Have you ever read that?
He wrote. I've heard of it. But I haven't read it.
It's classic. Yeah. Classic for every actor. Every actor should just look at it like once a year and be like, oh yeah, okay, that's why I'm feeling like that. I don't need to hire another manager or a different publicist or whatever it is when panic ensues.
well, I mean, bring me into this moment now. I mean, these are both projects that are, they're great projects and they're really different. As you think about your career, does it feel like a good place to be in, a good map going forward? It's a broad question, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. I mean, I always want to, you know, I mean, you always hope that a show hits and lands. You know, I feel like my work in We Are Who We Are was really great as well, but that show didn't quite land as much. And that was unfortunate. So yeah. you just hope that like the work that you're in, you're proud of and people watch it and it could help propel you and other people you respect will see it and consider you for something else or see a quality in you that maybe they weren't aware of or didn't think that you possessed for some reason.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most you can hope for and then get out there and talk about it.
Is there an element of revealing that kind of stuff to yourself, too? I mean, are there parts of these roles where you got to stretch or try things that or show things that you hadn't before?
I think in both of these roles, yeah, both of these roles were pretty new and challenging and daunting in their own ways. Next, I'd like to play a really lighthearted, glamorous character.
I'd love that.
Because, I mean, I never get to play a glamorous character. I was like, well, how come I've never played anybody glamorous?
Which is crazy for you, I feel like. That...
I know. I feel like, you know, like an unraveled, glamorous something is really like, you know, do.
Who's your dream director for that kind of role?
Dead or alive, Bob Fosse. But
okay, that's a great answer.
Yeah, alive, Coen Brothers. I think they do like an interesting kind of glamour.
Yeah, I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Are there any directors over the course of your career who have perhaps brought something out in you versus you maybe finding it in the writing where you discovered something in working with a filmmaker?
Oh, God, really putting me on the spot here.
That's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here for.
I think with like Luca and We Are Who We Are, like, I'm quite goofy in real life. And like he saw that in me and wanted to instill these moments where the mom is like being the goofy mom. And you're like, oh my God, the son's like, oh Lord. And
yeah,
I don't really get to do that on screen very much, or maybe I'm shy about it or, you know, it was really fun to do that with him. Once again, I trusted he would make me look beautiful.
A theme.
Well, no, I know, like, I feel like you can tell when someone really loves you, like Natasha or Luca or Jim, you know, like there's a love and a respect coming from these people that makes me feel really, I don't want to say seen, but seen in a way that maybe other people or haven't felt from some other filmmakers.
Sure.
I mean, most filmmakers you would hope would fall in love with the actors and, you know, but usually I try and seduce the camera operator.
That's where you go. That's...
But no, yeah. So yeah, Luca, yeah, he let me try stuff and that was really fun just to go out on a limb and you know, reveal more intimate aspects of my personality.
I'm hoping you got to do that again in his upcoming movie.
That's, yeah, top secret as far as I know.
I think it is top secret, but I did my best.
And now, Chris Murphy, we're going to hear your conversation with Matt Rogers, who also has two projects out this spring, one a movie, one a TV show. And he's someone who wasn't really on my radar, but I think you, having seen what he's involved in, really jumped at it. So introduce us to Matt Rogers.
Yeah, well, Matt Rogers came very prepared for our podcast interview because he also hosts an incredible podcast with SNL's Bowen Yang. So he had his own setup, his own mic. He was raring and ready to go, which was lovely to see. But yeah, it was really wonderful to talk to Matt. I've been a fan of Matt's work for years now. He sort of started in this queer comedy scene in New York and has since moved to LA. And I remember seeing him, you know, do these basement shows, and we talk about this on the episode, having to scale back his sort of natural energy and exuberance and sort of fit it to screen performances now, which is something that, you know, we didn't know was going to happen 5 or so years ago. And both projects are really, really fantastic. He stars in I Love That For You with Vanessa Bayer and Molly Shannon and Jennifer Lewis, and he takes the very familiar trope of the gay assistant and kind of turns it on its head and delves deeper into that experience and makes it a more lived-in experience while also being super funny and hilarious. So we really got into sort of what it means to take on a marginalized character that, you know, a couple of years ago maybe would get 3 lines in, you know, a one-off episode, and is now a central character on the show. And then we also sort of switched gears and talked about his great film, speaking of Bowen Yang, Fire Island, written by and starring Joel Kim Booster and also starring Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers, which I wrote a first look for Vanity Fair.
So you were in person on the set, in fact.
Exactly. I scammed my way into a free trip to Fire Island for a day on the company's dime. No, it was really great. And I got to spend a day on set and really see them working together as a group and Matt's really wonderful performance in a very different, a much freer, a much more, I'll say it, sluttier character than the one that he plays on I Love That For You. So it was really wonderful to sort of unpack both of these two very different screen performances with Matt. And
So people can watch I Love That For You now on Showtime, and Fire Island is out on Hulu in the beginning of June, right?
Indeed. I Love That For You is streaming now on Showtime. And yes, and Fire Island, it hits Hulu on June 3rd.
Thank you. Well done on all the plugs. Let's hear your conversation with Matt Rogers.
Matt Rogers, thank you so much for coming on Little Gold Men. So happy
to have you. I can't tell you enough how lovely it is to be here seeing you.
For those who don't know, I mean, I'm sure you all know, Matt is sort of a professional podcaster.
So my setup was already set up, in fact, from this morning.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's absolutely great. I always sort of imagined that I would be talking to Matt on his podcast, Las Culturistas, with Bowen Yang.
One of these days.
But it seems the tables have turned. oh, my goodness. But that's fantastic. But I want to dive in and talk about your fantastic new show on Showtime, I Love That For You, created by Vanessa Bayer, starring, you know, just some casual people, Vanessa Bayer, Molly Shannon, Jennifer Lewis, and yourself. What, can you just talk to me, you know, diving into that experience and sort of, you know, sharing the screen with such legends, let's just say it. What was that like?
Well, you have to imagine you're me and you walk into a room and it's Vanessa Bayer, Molly Shannon, Jennifer Lewis, and then you're also sort of, you know, expected to be there and perform. And it's sort of out of body, really. You can't pick people that are more formative for me. I mean, not in a weird way where it's like, it wasn't distracting. In fact, it was more, okay, this is actually, I'm here, let's get to their level. Mm-hmm. But it's tough when they're firing at such tens. And I mean, this show really gives them all the opportunity to really go there. Like, it's of course a great showcase for Vanessa, mm-hmm. but what happens with Jennifer and Molly's characters is just so, it's very demanding. And I spoke with Jennifer recently and she was saying, you know, I thought I signed on to do this little comedy and then it demanded so much of me. And you know, I think we're all just really excited and sort of emotional about people seeing it because it's a very special show with, like you said, incredible people. I mean, Molly, Jennifer, and Vanessa right there. I mean, that triumvirate.
That
How
trifecta.
Do you improve upon it? You
can't. You really can't. And I'm so glad. I guess we should talk about what the show is about because it's really laugh out loud funny, but it also has like a very sort of dark emotional center with Vanessa Bayer's character, Joanna Gold. She had childhood leukemia and beats it and then becomes a QVC host on a channel called SVN. And to keep her job, she says her cancer has come back. And it's really, that's right. In the pilot episode. And that immediately sets the tone and the place that, wow, we're like, it's hilarious, but it's also definitely dark. It's definitely dark. Not afraid to go there.
No, I mean, it's a Showtime comedy, and Showtime comedies, you know, they quote unquote have elbows, as it were. It really explores like the human psyche. And I'll just say basically the fun way of pitching it is it's basically The Devil Wears Prada, but set at the Home Shopping Network. And yes, I do get to be the Emily Blunt, which is sort of a gay man's dream. To say you're the Emily Blunt type in anything is really huge, but...
That's huge. It's amazing.
That is sort of the role I play. And basically, we find Vanessa's character at a time in her life where she feels like she's capable of so much, but is not doing anything in her life. And she feels that this thing from her childhood, which is that she was a cancer survivor, is holding her back because she's coddled by her parents. She doesn't have a relationship. You know, her friendships are surface at best, and she knows she's capable of so much professionally, and she has this dream. And, you know, by stroke of opportunity and talent, she does get the job. And when she finds out that it's a very cutthroat atmosphere, the Special Value Network, which, you know, you know, she really finds out that she has to have an on-air brand to connect with audiences, and she's never really had to think much about who she was outside of her illness and the way that people treat her. So she gets pushed to a very desperate point, and when she is going to lose her job, she makes a decision in a moment to lie about her reality, which is that she does not have cancer. She's fully cured and hasn't had it for so many years. And I think what the show explores is just how far we're willing to go into the depths of pretending to keep a facade up that will make us happy. It really explores just, you know, what we project to others versus the reality. Because I think we all know what it's like to be one thing but show another thing. You know, how to make yourself more marketable to people. How do you make yourself more palatable?
That's Instagram. That's social media. I mean, it's so crazy. It's everything. It's really, yeah, it really is.
And that's what makes it a great show for now, because I think on paper, Joanna Gold does something that, you know, if you read about it, you'd be like, put her in jail. But I think this explores the reality of what happens when someone feels they have no other choice. And, you know, it also really examines just our society today. Like, we as consumers, we accept so much about what we're told.
Yeah.
And we know so little about what really goes on. And, you know, I really enjoy being on a show that, like we said before, it really is funny. And it is a hard comedy first and foremost.
Laugh out loud.
But it also has these themes that make you really think about what I'm projecting, what I'm buying into. It's a very cool show.
I know, I love it. And it's in watching the show, it actually made me think like, wow, like was like QVC and SVN like sort of like ahead of the curve in terms of like, you know, on our whole lives now are about like how we're branded, how we're selling ourselves on social media and LinkedIn and all these different platforms. And QVC was selling stuff to us well before, you know, everything became an ad and everything became shoppable, right?
Literally. And I mean, you know, the thing about shopping, the thing about retail therapy and why it works is because it helps us feel like we're filling a hole.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It helps us feel like we are fulfilling something. You know, even just getting something in the mail, especially during a time like the pandemic, like sometimes it would be all I was looking forward to.
The only thing that we had, like, were physical things that we could hold and touch in our own houses.
Exactly. And, you know, it is so, there's this promise that we're going to be happier afterwards. Mm. And the thing about that dopamine hit of getting that thing in the mail or of feeling like you, you know, hit purchase on something that you really wanted is it does make you feel better. And so that is what connects people to these on-air hosts.
Yeah.
And they do all have these relatable brands, and it's just something that's very real and very prevalent in society. And the setting of the Special Value Network is, it's so easy to map so much onto it.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Byler and Vanessa Bayer co-created the show. They're brilliant. Jesse Klein was the showrunner. My dear friend Sudi Green, my best friend for so many years, is one of the co-EPs and was the writer on set. So it was always at the forefront, like, how do we maximize the comedy? But also, how do we tell this real story about people who, to some extent, are all lying about who they are.
Yes.
And you see that with all the supporting characters as the season progresses. You get to know everyone a little bit better, and you see what they project versus who they are and the desperate measures they'll take to be happy when they feel like they're lacking something in their life.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's so interesting and so spot on. And you'd think, I mean, from talking, it's so funny because when I started watching the show, I was like, oh, well, Matt's obviously going to be like one of the SVN hosts and whatnot, but your character actually, you know, is actually behind the scenes, is sort of like the little finger of the SVN world, like pulling the strings and sort of running everything. So can you talk to me a little bit about your character? Well, Darcy Lee, it's the best. It's just an incredible name.
A name that I don't think could possibly be real. I think his name is probably, you know, Anthony, and he picked the name Darcy to sound you know, more desirable on a resume. That's my theory.
That scans. It's such a good name, Darcy Leeds.
Basically, Darcy is the senior associate to Patricia Cochran, who is played by Jennifer Lewis in the show, and he will be the first to tell you that he is not her assistant.
No.
The reality is, he basically is her assistant. Yeah. But what I loved about the character when I read it in the audition was it really riffed on this idea of, you know, the gay assistant. Mm-hmm. Someone who comes in and just serves the purpose of asking someone what flavor pressed juice they're going to like today, where they could put something down, what they should do with a call coming in. You know, I've auditioned for so many of these types of roles.
I can only imagine.
And especially, you know, during pilot season, which is when this came in, I had gotten just a sea of the same character that really didn't have much depth beyond that. And so when I read in the audition sides that this character's first line is, just so you know, I'm more than what you think, and then whether or not that's true was really explored in the show, I thought, this is going to be really smart. And then that's in the whole script. It's just such a smart show. But what I loved about this character is actually, they do walk the walk, mm-hmm. and you get to understand so much more about this person who has made his professional environment his entire life, and what happens when a person starts to feel devalued or like they're going to be trapped when they've already decided to make an environment their entire life. And he does go to some desperate places. And what I really appreciate about the writing of this character, and what I was so fun to play, was the code switching that has to be done when someone is really good at their job in a professional environment. You know, he's one person with Patricia. He is another person with Vanessa, who he loves to run status on. And any opportunity he gets to let anyone know that he's above them and able to dictate their schedule, he's going to take, because he has so little power.
Yes.
And then you also see, as the series progresses, his relationships with his colleagues, particularly his best friend, who's the on-air host, Bethann McGann, played by Aidan Mayeri.
Wait, can you say that again? She is such an amazing name on the
Beth
show.
Bethann McGann.
Bethann McGann.
You'll find that a lot of the on-air hosts have three-word names, which is just a small, fun detail. but yeah, so you really see who he is through that relationship, and you get a sense of his goals. You see in episode two, you know, he is wanting more than just this job, and he is sort of at the whim of Patricia, played by Jennifer, to sort of give him those opportunities. And she knows that. So it's actually a very dynamic relationship that, you know, we'll see how toxic it gets and what unfolds.
Oh, I can't wait. And that's something that I immediately clued in, because, of course, like, we know the gay assistant trope. And for a while, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago on sitcoms or on television, you'd get the gay assistant for maybe, you know, three lines and then they'd be gone. And now in this sort of like, I would say, I love that for you, is a part of this amazing, like, queer revolution in terms of, like, taking these marginalized characters that normally, you know, might have two lines, like, you might see in, like, you know, a 30 Rock cutaway, and putting them at the center and giving them an actual, you know, a life with stakes and apps and wants and dreams, and also making it funny. I just really was impressed by that.
And the fact is, you never know if that's what you're going to get or not. Because even though I felt there was potential in the first episode, I'm still a gay actor in Hollywood. You know what I mean? Who's at this point in my career just now booking these types of roles. So, you know, someone at number six on the call sheet, you know, there are no guarantees with three incredible leads like this that you're not just going to get, you know, the quote unquote, like, sassy one-liners, which I shiver even saying. Not that they're not effective, but you don't want that to be the reality of your entire character. Yeah. And then when I got the second episode, and pretty much the first scene is a glimpse into his desires and his aspirations, and you see the stakes between he and Jennifer's character, it's just, it was really, really exciting for me. Because I haven't really gotten the opportunity to play a character like this. And then you get it on such a high level. Mm-hmm. And every episode, I mean, we would be getting new episodes of this show and you could hear screams coming from everyone's trailer. I mean, every episode gets better and the plots get thicker. And it's just one of those little shows that I don't think anyone is going to see coming. And it's just... it's just good. It's just so good. And I'm critical, and you know I'm critical.
I absolutely know that you're critical, and as am I. And I will say, speaking of good, your work in the second episode, like, you do some really subtle, like, sort of like heartbreaking. It's like, it's funny, but some really emotional, like, subtle, like, Nicole Kidman ass work.
Nicole Kidman ass work is getting pulled for my press quotes. That's for sure.
Well, I think it's really great. And so you're a comedian. You used to live in New York. I can't tell you the amount of times I've seen you absolutely slay on a big stage and just be so funny. I would love to know, like, taking that energy and all of your gifts and that, and paring it down to, like, you know, a 30-minute television series. What was that like? And having some, like, serious acting moments to sort of deliver.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I will say, when I first got the breakdown for the character, he was described as dry.
Mm.
And I think I'm one of the wettest people around.
I would say you've definitely been dipped in a pool. I could definitely see. Yeah.
Well, you know, she's a Pisces, rising Pisces, Cancer moon. She is by definition soaking wet.
Soaking wet.
But,
sure.
You know, it was interesting because I thought to myself, you know, they'll find someone else for this because I'm not someone who's ever been told that my smallness is my gift as an actor. Like, in fact, I commonly get the note to, you need to throw it away. And so I had done enough of that. And I had, you know, sat around and watched enough. And I feel, you know, I got to a point where I was comfortable just going in there and being, because I internalized the dialogue and it was so good. So that when I went to my audition, I really just kind of threw it away.
Wow.
And treated it like it was another day at work. Mm-hmm. And because for him it is, you know, even if he's selling Janine by Janine placemats. And
another incredible name.
Like, for him, that's a brand he deals with all the time. And it was just second nature to him. And I actually found that, you know, I really enjoyed doing this type of thing, but it is different for me, someone who was born screaming in basements in New York City. You know what I mean? Like, I came up through sketch comedy. I was a UCB kid. I, you know, ran my sketch group at NYU, Hammercats. And I
saw those shows. I went to a Hammercats show back in the day.
Ooh. And I love you for that. Mm-hmm. And I love that for us. And no, you've always been so supportive. And I love you so much. And that's like a real... coming through the New York comedy community is a real badge of honor for me, because I feel like I came up around so many incredible people. And, you know, not just Bowen. I'm talking about Joel Kinbooster, Catherine Cohen, you know, Mitra Juhari, Patty Harrison. You know, these are my friends.
Yes.
So to see these people sort of come up through the entertainment industry and now be, you know, movers and shakers, it's like so great to be involved in that. But also, it is a hard transition from the wildness of that to this on-camera acting, and it was different for me. And like I said, you know, I walk in and then I'm surrounded by these greats, and I know Molly Shannon also comes from sketch comedy, but what people need to understand is this woman is an incredibly talented dramatic actor, and all the cast is like that. So you do raise your game a little bit, and, you know, Fire Island and I Love That For You have given me these incredible opportunities to act, which is always what I was and wanted to be, but I was getting opportunities, you know, in the podcasting space with Las Culturistas, and you got to take what I'm like a workhorse. You got to take what you get.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
and why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not a linear role, you know, or a linear path necessarily to get to star, you know, on a television series or, you know, Fire Island film, which we were definitely about to talk about, which I'm frankly obsessed with and have been for many months now.
You wrote such an amazing piece on it, and we were all so moved by it.
Oh my! I had the best time on set. I got to spend a glorious
day. And when you came, it was
day.
So fun.
It was so. Yeah. It was such a fantastic day, and I was like, oh yeah, for work, I get to go and just see these people that I think are the funniest people, just like be funny in a magical, but and we have You're to say best. Problematic sort or not problematic, but a complicated space like Fire Island, which I think the movie does such a great job of showing the dynamic there. It is, you know, it's heaven and hell. It's a microcosm of our world, which is complex and nuanced and not always sunshine and lollipops and roses.
No. And, you know, I think, you know, Joachim Booster wrote the film, and he is such a thoughtful, intuitive, observant person and therefore a writer. And it's based on Pride and Prejudice, which maps perfectly onto this film.
It's really shocking how well it really works without sort of giving anything away. But like,
well, Jane Austen was a talented girl. You know, she had a gift with the pen.
She was a slay,
whatever,
some
the
might
quill,
say.
Whatever. She was a slay.
She was a slay, that Jane.
But yeah, it's a timeless story, and there's a reason why it's been told time and time again, over and over and over. Because I think that, especially with the gay community, the queer community now in Fire Island, I mean, in terms of social hierarchy and social strife and social struggle and class systems, you know, and the wanting and the desiring and the having not, that really maps onto Fire Island so well. And what Joachim did so beautifully is he did not shy away from any of the realities.
Oh, no.
I think that there is obviously a race issue within mm-hmm. the queer community. And when you go to Fire Island, it is magnified times 10.
Yes.
And it is he's described it this way, so I feel I can. It is an inherently racist and classist system.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the film, in using Pride and Prejudice as a container, really explores that. And it is a really fun movie, and it's hilarious, and we have so much fun in it, and explores the highs and lows of the Fire Island experience to great comedic effect. But also, I think what people are going to be really surprised by, and it was also achieved by Andrew Ahn, our amazing director, mm-hmm. is just how real I think it gets and how much weight it gives the experience of being an other in Fire Island, whatever that means for you. But it's a movie that I'm really proud to be a part of.
It really is. It's just so great. Honestly, it's sort of like a through line with both of these projects where it's like you get like they're laugh out loud comedies. It's like comedy with a capital C, but like without sacrificing the emotional core, what's actually going on underneath emotionally. And in Fire Island, it's more, you know, systemically, societally, and like these mm-hmm. things that like being, you know, being a black gay guy who loves Fire Island, I know exactly. I very much saw myself represented in Joel's experience in the film and Bowen's experience in the film. And I can't think of any sort of film or queer storytelling devices where I can often say that. And I can definitely say I never really felt that way when reading Jane Austen. No offense, Jane. Love that. I never really saw myself, you know, right. in that, which makes a totally different time and place. But I do. It's so great because as you were just talking about how so many people from this sort of New York alt comedy scene are blowing up in all these amazing ways. This movie is a testament. I mean, it's you, it's your best friends, it's you, it's Joel, it's Bowen. What was that experience like? How was that?
It is something, obviously, I'll never forget. There should be a movie about the making of this movie. Sometimes I think, obviously.
Right, that's what I tried to write.
You have to imagine. It was like, you know, 9 or 10 queer men and Margaret Cho, the icon, mm-hmm. like all living together on Fire Island for a couple weeks. And then we shot the rest of it, you know, in comps locations in Brooklyn and Long Island. But we were all really together the whole time, very close, sort of having this meta experience doing this film with these themes about an environment where many of us just had been for vacation, will go again for vacation. And it's so funny because when we were shooting it, we were living it in a way that I don't think I will ever replicate with another project. But also, I think it almost was good that we were all in this little fishbowl together doing it, because the weight of it is, you know, it's major. I think that a lot of the gay community and the queer community, the whole LGBTQ plus community, is going to be seeing this. And that is a lot of pressure. You know, I've been involved in queer projects before, and I know that the queer community has a high bar for the way that art represents them, and we should.
Yes. Can be critical, as we said. We're a critical bunch, and that's good. But that can also be hard, and that can also be mean, and that can sometimes be, so it's, I can totally understand that, having that
weight. I think we all really tried to protect each other during it. We became very close. It's like a family. And I think that the entire time we just knew we were a part of something special, but mostly at the time of shooting, it was special because of the way we're all feeling together.
Yeah.
And it was the chemistry of the group. And like you said, you know, Joel and Bowen are my closest friends. Like, that is true. Mm-hmm. But I became so close with Tomas Matos, who plays Keegan in the
phenomenal
film. I became very close to Zane Phillips, who plays Dex. I became closer with James Scully. You know, I just, like, Conrad Rickamora is such a star in this movie.
Fantastic.
And so it was a mix of my sisters and also people who became family to me. And it was like that across the board. And I'd really feel that if I'm most proud of one thing, it's the fact that that chemistry really shines through. Torian Miller, when he wrapped his scenes for the movie, we were all crying. Like, the last scene that we ever shot with Torian was, I won't spoil it, but it's at the underwear party he's sort of having a moment and needs to step away.
100%.
That was his last scene, and we were all just in tears. I mean, and when everyone rapped on the movie, it was like a mini celebration. And I recently saw the movie for a second time, because of course when you see something the first time, it's sort of that sort of dysmorphic shock you go through, that's
me in a
movie. What am I
doing? Yeah.
Yeah, and even with I Love That For You, like, I'll be sitting here enjoying it. Like, I'm like, oh my God, Vanessa's so good. This is so funny. And then I'll walk in and I'll be like, no, girl, this isn't real.
This is not real.
I remember
this is
faking
fake.
That. Yeah.
That deep fake there.
Yeah, I'm like, that's me in that suit dressed up like this character.
Yeah, but it's me. Yeah, I can imagine that being sort of a crazy moment to experience.
I'll get better at this, but you know, for right now, that's how I feel.
100%.
But you know, and I saw it a second time, and when it got to the end of the movie, there's a certain song that plays, and there's just an image that the last scene of the movie, and I broke down. I really am so proud to be a part of something that, okay, this is therapy.
Yeah.
If I had shown to my 11-12 year old self, I think that his life would have been easier. I think that it's all about projecting that back to a younger generation, and also paying homage to generations that have come prior.
Yeah.
I just felt like just the images of love and the images of sisterhood and the images of, you know, specifically queer celebration are ones that are so pure and beautiful. And I know they were so pure and beautiful in the moment. So to see it captured in this legendary atmosphere with these incredible people that I believe in so much and have believed in for so long, I'm literally on the edge right now.
Yes.
But it's just surreal to be a part of it. And that's, I think, something that I'm taking with me and going forward with, is I was a part of it. I will always be up there on screen with them in this moment. And, you know, regardless of what people take from it or want to say about it, I know what it means to me now as someone who can watch it and remember it. And now we get to give it up to everybody. And that was a really hard one, you know, like, there is that process of it's ours right now, and then it will be someone else's, you know, and I've had that with many different things, but with this, it was such a formative experience and such an stepping into adulthood and stepping into a new phase of, you know, my and everyone else's careers, that this is going to be a hard one to give up to everybody, but I'm excited to.
I think you really should be. I mean, that was really beautiful. I had like actual goosebumps. That was some Nicole Kidman-ass work. Well,
you were
there.
You know what I mean? Like you were there to write the piece, and you know you were there the day we shot the scene at T.
Yes.
What a good day to come.
Great. It was gorgeous. And what a fun day. Peter Smith, they were so funny.
They were amazing. And they're such a scene stealer in the movie, too.
Really, just they make such an impression.
Crushed it.
And it's just one of those things where and I felt that even then. But you go to set or you see movies get made and you don't know what the final product is going to be until you see, you know, TC. You know, I believed in the project. I thought it was great. But then to watch it and to see that, not only is this like a queer movie, because that's the one thing, but it's a queer movie for queer people. Like it's yes. specifically for, it's not, you know, it can be for everyone, but it's not made for, how do we like not offend as many people as possible so that we can make so much money so that, you know, Miramax can blah, blah, blah. You know, it's not that. It's a film about a real experience that queer people have, a specific experience that then becomes unique that anyone can tap into that is not pandering to this sort of like amorphous crowd that I just really, it felt personal and real to me and also made me laugh, which I think needs to be said.
Yeah, that's another thing too. I was like, I want to stress that it's funny. You know what I mean?
It's and very
I,
funny.
I will say like, you know, Joel and Bowen, they dig so deep in the movie, but there is so much of that so much is reflected back to the audience that I think they'll recognize in their friend groups. Mm. You know, the like sort of casual dragging we all do of each other, the laziness, the lounging, because it's equal parts. I'm calling it equal parts slutty and soulful.
Ooh, I love that.
That's my own little.
That's good. That's the pull quote. Press. Slutty and soulful. That's
how I feel about it. You know, and but in the soul of the movie is really in the friendship, and you feel that when you go to Fire Island and you're all waking up and you're in your sweatpants and you're on your phones, like, you know, and you're just chilling and, you know, and you're just chilling and, you know, you have like dinner all together. Like,
yeah,
we all know those moments, and it is equal parts that and what's found in those moments that it is, you know, going out to the underwear party and like divvying out drugs.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, it really is an accurate portrayal of what goes down. And therefore it makes me even more proud because I feel like we got it right. You know what
yes.
I mean? It could be one thing to have an experience, but then it's another thing to actually feel like we captured it. And when I watch it, I was like, oh my God, I feel like I went, yeah. You know, the island is shot so beautifully.
It's gorgeous. The sunsets, oh my God, the beaches. It's really, it's so beautiful. Yeah, and it's
Felipe,
like,
RDP. Oof. So good.
So good. And it's one of those things where it's like, I watched it. I was like, oh, I'm excited for the summer. I was like, oh, I have something to look forward to. Like, I gotta get there. I gotta go there.
Yeah, and it's a real love letter. It is.
I want to talk a little bit about your character of Luke and like,
yeah.
Do you think like, Luke, if you put Luke and Darcy in a room, what do you think would happen?
I would hope they would hook up. No,
honestly,
kidding.
I think they'd think
Well, Luke is such a slut.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. And Darcy is so pent up and needs it so bad.
Absolutely.
You know what? This is that kind of weird that I'm like thinking about the sexual chemistry between two people that I play? But, you know, Luke is a lot more loose, I think. Like, so it was really fun to channel sort of like a flirtatious energy, and you know, Joel did write it with me in mind, which I both think take as a compliment and also as a full drag.
That's
like when it was announced that I was playing like the Lydia comp, mm-hmm. all the Pride and Prejudice fans were like, of course Matt's doing that, and I was like, all right, relax.
I get it, yeah,
but like, he is the messy sister.
Yeah,
and he gets into trouble for sure, in a way that I'm really proud of the way it's mapped onto this movie, and I think it gets really real. And I'm super excited about the way that was executed, and think I'm really excited about the am I excited about the discourse? I don't know, but I anticipate a discourse about it.
There will be discourse.
There will be discourse, which I welcome. And then with Darcy, you know, so much of it is he's thinking a lot more about the control he has over himself and his atmosphere than Luke is, who I think has no regard for any sort of control. He's more wanton in that way. So I think that they would look at each other with curiosity and maybe honestly even a little bit of longing because of what the other has. But
yeah, they're very different. They're very different characters. They're very different. They're sort of on polar opposite ends of sort of like a, you know, uninhibitedness spectrum, if you had to say, you know, in terms of who keeps things sort of close to their chest or sort of buttoned up and is, you know, sort of like, yeah, perfectly composed. That's definitely more Darcy Leeds. And then you got Luke, who's, you know, a free bird.
Yeah, I think that, you know, where Luke starts in the movie and where Luke ends in the movie is sort of where lessons are learned, and he you'll see how that plays out. And with Darcy, I'm excited to see you see a complete unraveling.
Yeah.
So,
another Nicole Kidman-ass moment. Well, I'll say it myself. I'll say it.
Well, I mean, you've only seen the first two episodes, but I'm really excited because I think that the show becomes, and the show is always a vehicle for Vanessa, but it opens up to the ensemble in ways that are so exciting, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to be on the show. I still can't even believe I booked the show, to be honest with you.
Guess what? You threw it away. You said it yourself. Actors throw it away. Throw it away. If there's one thing you take away from this podcast, actors throw it away.
Yeah, I'm just encouraging all the actors out there to not try.
Not try.
So I can swoop in and book.
And that's smart. And that's the tea.
It's a tactic. I learned something from Darcy. I know about, you know.
That's very calculating and that's very smart. That's really great. Oh my goodness. Well, Fire Island, it hits Hulu on June 3rd. So you gotta stream it once it hits. And I love that for you. It's on Showtime and, you know, it's every Sunday, right? It's really fantastic.
It airs on Sunday and streams on Fridays, which is sort of very queer to have like two debuts. Yes. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's the streaming age. That's the thing, you know?
Yeah, I'm excited for people to find it and binge it, because I think it's going to be a great binge. Like, obviously watch it every week as it rolls out, but two, it's like one of those shows that, especially as the season gets going, you're going to really be wanting to see what happens next. I'm really excited that we have a full-on cliffhanger at one point.
Ooh, baby. I haven't gotten there yet, so I'm okay. Nope. My interest is piqued. I'm definitely leaning in. And then also listen to, like, I mean, if you're listening to this, you know that Matt has an amazing podcast with Bowen Yang from SNL. You gotta get him wherever you can. And next time, you know, well, this time you're on Vanity Fair, and next time I'll come over there.
Okay, perfect. I mean, honestly, we just had a 300th episode, so it feels crazy, but it's been going for 6 years.
That's great. That can't be true, because I remember the first episodes. It's still fun.
That does it for today's show. We'll be back on Thursday with our usual roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com, tweet at us at littlegoldman about who else you might want to hear us talk to, or sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldman, or text the number 718-550-2059. This week's episode was edited and produced, as always, by Brett Fuchs.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.